everybody, okay. And welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 47. I'm Charles Lowell, and with me today is Noel Rappin. Before we get into who you are, because I know that a lot of people know you already and you need no introduction, you're actually calling in from Chicago today, right?
That's true. Yes, I am.
Did anyone actually show up for work today?
You know, people did actually show up for work a little bit later. So this is being recorded the day after the Cubs won the World Series last night. I will say that my commute in the parking lot at the commuter rail station in the suburbs was surprisingly empty this morning. And people were a little bit slow to come in. The game didn't end until about midnight last night.
Oh, man, I'm neither a Cleveland nor a Chicago fan, Chicago Cubs fan, but it was a harrowing game that almost gave me a heart attack. I can't even imagine what it was like.
Cubby blue since I was a kid, so... You know, it was something.
Really? Wow. You're from Chicago?
Yeah, I grew up in Chicago. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs and, I went away for school and, worked, in Boston for a while, but came back about 12 years ago.
Okay. And so that kind of leads me into the perfect setup for one of our questions is like, how did you get into development? I've known about you since I got into the Ruby community, you know, probably back in 2010, something like that. How did you come to be there?
So I was one of those kids who I'm a developer of a certain age, I guess. And I had an Apple II, and started programming AppleSoft Basic in the mid 80s, I guess. And eventually decided that I enjoyed it enough and got pretty overeducated at that. In that sense, a very traditional background. I went and worked at what we would now call a web consulting company around 2000. My first professional job is 98-2000. I had done a lot of different languages as a student. That job was mostly in Cold Fusion and then eventually bounced around doing a bunch of different, mostly web development solutions. At some point along the way, picked up the Ruby Pickaxe book and then eventually came to Rails. I started doing Rails as a hobbyist, either pre-1.0 or very early 1.0. I used it to build some like a task tracker for my team and a couple of other little tools like that. And relatively shortly thereafter, started doing it professionally.
So I think you're kind of the same generation that I am. I call us pizza kids from that early 2000s, you know, web development background where it's like kind of fueled by pizza and Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, a little bit. My first professional job was at a company that was a very, very small consulting company based in Miami and Boston. And they were not developers, the people who ran the company. They had been documentary filmmakers. And there's like a whole 90s technology trajectory here because they were documentary filmmakers and then they were documentary CD makers. And then they were asked to add like interactive stuff to the CDs that they were putting out. And then they became web developers as sort of a natural extension. And suddenly it was like 1998. Every company in the universe wanted to be on the web. And they were like, oh, this seems like a good business to be in. And they started trying to hire like actual programmers who knew what they were doing, even though I was just out of grad school and didn't know what I was doing, but it was convincingly pretend. So yeah, we did all the stuff then that would be like the first application that I worked there, the production server lived under my desk and was also the staging server and the development server. We didn't use at that point source control, although eventually we did start using source control. It was just, there were no, established conventions of what was a good thing to do.
Yeah. The production server under the desk, a more elegant weapon for a more civilized age.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Old.
That was a while back, but you've obviously been doing a lot more structured, a lot more kind of formal development over the course of the year or over the course of your career. So most of us, like myself included, were kind of content to, you know, write the software, maybe blog about it every once in a while, I give the occasional conference talk, but you've really, really like dove in to those activities and really kind of taken the time to really, for the topics that you're interested in, really kind of research them very thoroughly to the point where, you know, you've actually written several books. And, you know, when I think about like the concept of writing a book, it sounds like, oh my goodness, that sounds terrible. That sounds like, you know, having my teeth pulled out or something like that. But you've done it multiple times. So I'm curious, did you experience that kind of fear and uncertainty? And what was kind of the decision-making process that led up to like, no, this is something that I've got to do. I'm going to sign up for this. I'm going to do this. And I'm going to make this commitment.
Well, okay. Fear and uncertainty is a different question. I mean, I've always written things. I was writer in some ways even before I was a programmer. So being able to combine the two is just is something that I really enjoy doing. And I've always really enjoyed teaching. The more cynical way to doing that is I enjoy like explaining things in a way that makes me sound smart. But I've always enjoyed doing it in whatever context. So I've always, when I'm not writing, I've always often been involved in training at the places that I work or other things like that. And I've always been a little bit of a theater background and a little bit of a performance background, and conference talks are a way to still scratch that itch a bit.
You mentioned that you had a like a graduate degree.
No, my graduate degree is in computer science, but I did a lot of amateur theater things in high school and college. It's not something that I have a whole lot of other outlet for other than talking about development.
You wouldn't think that it's a natural thing, but I think that, you know, the best talks and the best blogs and the best like books like have that element of theatricality to them.
You know, I try in the books to give them a little bit of a voice. Sometimes that's, you know, you get interesting responses when you try to make a technical book a little bit funny. Mm-hmm. Some people really don't like it and other people really respond to it. And I do it, you know, sometimes just as a way to maintain my own interest in, you know, the 14th page of this chapter on something.
Yeah.
You know, as far as like the fear and uncertainty, like that never really goes away. Like I have a book out, you know, that I'm writing now about payments, which is a very serious topic. And as much as I've done work in that, and as much as I've done research on that, there are obviously people out there who have done more work and more and know more, certainly about individual pieces of it. And there are a lot of people who are going to take anything that I write and, you know, implement it that way. They're going to take it as the way that things are done. So that does introduce a tremendous amount of unsettling.
Yeah, you're on the hook. They're like, but Noel told me that this was the way to do it, and I went out of business.
Yeah, so this is actually – it's actually the payment book, which is called Take My Money, is actually only the second book in the history of pragmatic programmers to have a disclaimer, a legal disclaimer at the beginning, which I'm very proud of. And, you know, I think that the thing that is the most worrying, especially when writing something long, is not so much factual errors, because I can check facts. Facts can be checked. Emphasis is much, much harder to check. And like cultural community practices are much, much harder to check. And so I'm often much more worried about the idea that I might spend a lot of time on something that nobody really is interested in, or that I might not spend time on a really important thing just because it's a part of the world that I don't know as well as other people in there. And therefore I miss something. Factual errors, I worry about them too, but factual errors are relatively easy to catch often, not always. Many, many years ago, I wrote for Rock's beginner Rails book, which was purchased by approximately nobody worldwide. But it's got one of those, you know, beautiful Rock's black and white cover pictures of the author on it looking like terrible. And at that point, you know, I had worked in Rails professionally, but only for a very, very short time. And there were certainly people who had a lot more experience than I did. But for whatever reasons, I had the book contract. In that context, there's a lot of uncertainty around not being sure that I know what the newest tools are or what the best practices are.
How do you mitigate that? Like, how do you just kind of say, like, yeah, how do you address that?
Research is one way. Like, I think that – so there are pluses and minuses to not being the greatest expert of something when you're writing a book like this. You know, one of the pluses is that your experience is a little bit more immediate. And it's a little bit easier for you to make it relevant to somebody coming to it for the first time. But then a lot of times you wind up doing the kinds of things that you might do if you were actually trying to learn it. But then I am a pretty good researcher, and then I can compress that down into something that it took me, you know, 4 or 5 hours to Google or research, or days to figure out the best practice, or search, you know, talk to some experts sometimes. And then I can hopefully distill that down to something so that you don't have to go on that entire journey. You can just cut to the chase a little bit. So, you know, it's researching, it's finding the people who do seem to be prominent in a particular technology or a particular skill, and finding out what they're doing. Sometimes it's getting it wrong, hopefully not very often. And sometimes it's just like, this is the best I can do, and I have to let it, you know, I can't solve every problem.
Right. Just being satisfied with that.
Yeah.
I get it. That makes a lot of sense. Like you mentioned that the book that you just wrote, the one about taking payments on the web. You know, I saw that and I looked at it and I was like, oh, duh, there totally needs to be this book. This book totally needs to exist. And thanks that it actually got written. But like in hindsight, it's obvious that there wasn't really anything that like had treated web payments as this holistic topic that needed to be addressed. And yet, when I look at the last 5 years, the last 10 years, this is a body of knowledge. It's been part of, you know, what, 90% of the applications that I've developed. And it's been something integral. And like, there have been like patterns and stuff developed around it. But I've never really thought, about it of like, oh, we need to draw this circle around this practice. And this needs to be researched and fleshed out. And, you know, there needs to be at least some guide on how to do this. And so I think from my perspective, looking in hindsight, seeing when it was published, oh, yeah, that's totally obvious that that should have existed. But being on the other end, looking into the future of what are, given the infinite number of things that I could write about and I could research, how do you go about kind of the selection process and saying this is something that really ought to exist?
So this came about in kind of interesting to me, I guess. So I actually, I mean, the preface of the book states this out pretty clearly. Like I, a few years ago, started working on, you know, not a large web project by any means, but certainly one that had a fair amount of complicated business logic around their payments. And we inherited it with the payment gateway in place. And I kind of thought that, oh, well, the payment gateway is there. That's the hard part. We're, you know, this is basically set. And, you know, pretty quickly learned that that was not the case. And started really looking for like best practices, things, people who had solved similar problems on the assumption that a lot of people had to have solved similar problems. Like one thing in particular that I was looking at was like handling the failure case. I have to do something in my database and I have to process the credit card and they can't happen simultaneously, but the failure of one affects how I process the other. And just looking around for how other people had solved that and really being surprised at how little information I found about something like that. So I kind of filed that away. And about a little over a year ago, I had this weird idea that I was going to start doing some self-publishing again and started writing about this or thought about writing this as part of that, writing about payments and data modeling and stuff like that. And as I started getting into it, I was like, oh, I've had enough issues here that this is longer than like a blog post and this is longer than a magazine article. There's kind of a lot here. So I worked with Pragmatic, so I know the editors there, and I sent them a proposal, and they pushed back a little bit on the idea of, well, you know, Stripe has documentation. What else do you need? And I was like, you know, why? There are all these issues here. And they know, like, you know, Dave, they run their own web store. They wrote their own code. And I actually was part of what I got out of the contract was I got to interview Dave Thomas about how the Pragmatic store works, which was great. It was really neat.
Did actually that material make it into the book itself?
Not as such, because I was a little reluctant to directly quote him about the internals of the Pragmatic store, but some of the principles that he talked about. Anyway, it was actually kind of reassuring that about 85% of it agreed with stuff I already thought I knew, and about 15% of it sort of went beyond that. They have some problems that are, you know, because they're actually managing physical inventory, which not all web stores do.
Right.
Which introduces a whole host of other problems. So, you know, so it became it was a combination of like, I actually really do think I've worked on a lot of these problems and they're interesting. And a lot of people seem to have similar problems and there's not a whole lot here. And so that seemed like a book was a way for me to go on that. Other people might have gone in a different direction. I am getting kind of an interesting reaction from people. Like I get a lot of people who are saying, wow, I really could have used that book 2 years ago. And not a lot of people saying, I really need to buy this book right now, which indicates maybe the marketing needs to be tweaked a little bit. I'm pretty sure it will, you know, it's not even fully out yet. So it will, you know, it will find its audience, but it's interesting how I think people still, even seeing the book is there, assume that they know more about what they're getting into when they start doing payments.
Yeah.
And then they come out the other end a couple years later and they go, oh, wow, I really wish I had a guide on that.
Yeah. So what you need to do, the marketing needs to be something along the lines of like, don't need this book 2 years from now. Like, yeah. Don't be the person who wishes they'd read this 2 years from now. Read it now.
If I had this book when we started, like I would have saved so much time
and
not made so many mistakes.
Yeah. It's always interesting to me, the interplay between kind of the patterns and evolving and documenting the patterns and how eventually that kind of precipitates code that makes those patterns automatic. But it feels like there's always this kind of leading edge where you have to kind of explore the problem space and do the research. And then eventually you can kind of churn and digest and write little pieces of it, but eventually it becomes like code. Has there been actual code, like any like plugins or stuff that has fallen out of this or that people can like reference directly?
Yeah, not as such. There's a reference application in the book, but I mean, I submitted a couple of patch requests to a couple of gems along the way of, but nothing significant. It's pretty unusual for me to come out of a book like this with a lot of like new open source tools. They're usually more about using the things that are already there. But the book definitely has a opinionated set of thoughts about how you design a Rails application. And it's pretty upfront about that. Like this is, you know, we're going to put all our workflow logic in their own objects. And we're going to not put a lot of stuff in the active record models. And we're going to do it for these reasons. And like the first chapter of the book actually is like not even payments. It's just shopping carts and a way to talk about the data model and the design. Because ultimately, like money has some weird aspects, but a lot of it is just principles of doing good software design, encapsulated software design, and the way you would deal with any big external third-party dependency. But then on top of that, you have the specific pieces of money is weird. Like money has real-world implications and has legal implications and things like that.
Yeah, there's definitely, whenever you're dealing with money, there's an elevated level of pressure that seems like it's put on. And I know personally, when I think of like, you know, so lately it was writing my very first payment system. We actually maintained for a while the Stripe Rails gem, which had moderate popularity. We don't maintain it anymore. But it was that project where we did that, where I kind of became an information hoarder. And it kind of started me on this journey of like never destroying information, kind of the immutability and like functional programming and stuff like that, because I was so worried about overwriting any information about the payments coming in that it was like, you just like, let's capture it from the webhook and write it to the database and like replicate it and back it up. And like, let's never throw away a fact.
The specific advice in the book is save as little of your user's personal information as you can and as much of the transaction information as you possibly can.
Yeah.
So it definitely recommends saving the entire response from the payment gateway. It recommends making sure that you store all of the pieces of your partial price calculation so that you could recreate it even if the logic changes, because that's something that has specifically bitten me in actual world.
Can you elaborate on that when you say partial price information? And
yeah, so the application that I work on, it sells tickets and it has a processing fee. And originally the processing fee was whatever the processing fee was, and I hard-coded it as a constant in the code base. Because I thought I do not need to write this processing fee to the database for every individual pet transaction, because I was wrong. And eventually, of course, they changed the processing fee, which would be fine if you never had to look backwards
right.
at all and try to run a report of old transactions and try to validate
right.
that the prices on old transactions were still held. So, you know, they change this transaction fee and then they start running reports and all of the reports are off by, you know, whatever the changed amount was.
Right. I see. So you can still maybe store that constant in the code base, but you have to at least write out what it was at that point when you did the transaction.
Yeah. So what I recommend, and not all of this has managed to make its way back to the legacy code mass that I'm actually dealing with, but what I recommend is saving like all of the individual pieces, you know, what the unit price, any processing fees, any shipping fees, any tax fees, any discounts, like saving those all as they were calculated as part of the transaction so that you always have them and they're not dependent on the code or the logic staying the same, because all of that logic will change.
Yeah, I'm all about information hoarding. I think it's it's useful stuff.
Yeah, I even started recommending, like originally, you know, a failed transaction was in a database transaction, so it would go away. But I think that that's a bad idea. I think that you need to save whether you actually save a failed transaction in your database or whether you log something, the information of those failed transactions is really important. And you want to make sure that you hold on to that stuff and you can go back and look at
right.
it. Because the idea that a bunch of transactions are silently failing and you don't know about it, like that's problematic.
So it sounds like you're still working on this application that was kind of which fomented the book, right?
Yeah. Although I'm a lot more critical of the code now that I've gone through and like the book made me sort of think about this stuff a little bit more systematically than I had. And made me make a lot of things concrete that weren't quite in the original application. So the code in the book is actually better than the code in the application.
Of course.
It's also a lot simpler.
It's right. Exactly. Cause it doesn't actually have to do the real work. It just has to capture the principle.
Right. It just has to be a good enough facade to show the ideas.
Right. But so you're still working in this application that kind of served as the template for the book. So, but I'm curious then how you manage that, because, you know, for me, writing a blog post is hugely time consuming. Writing a book must be even more so. Do you just have it dialed in that well that you can just like bang it out, or do you mix doing the book writing with working on the application? Because obviously it sounds like both are kind of crucial to each other. And how do you, you know, you've already said like the fact that I wrote the book is actually informing the way that I structure the code that made me write the book in the first place. And so like, how do you interleave those activities to make a kind of a continuous workflow?
Well, there's a separation there, because the book is the thing I do not at work. Like, the book is the thing I do. That's my side project, effectively. So I'm not ever mixing them in the sense that I'm really going back and forth between one thing and the other. The application is the thing I do at work. The book is the thing I do at home. They inform each other, obviously, but separating them is not usually a problem. They're not the thing I do at the same time. So they don't relate to each other that directly.
Right. I see.
It's time consuming, but it's what I do instead of maintaining an open source project or doing some other community thing in what would be side project kind of time.
I see. So you just do it on your spare time.
Yeah, I used to joke that it was written between 10 and midnight for people who would read it between 10 and midnight.
I like that conception. Do you think it would work at all if, say, at your job, like there were some amount of time allocated for writing the book? Because I think it's clearly, like I said, there is some interplay, and hopefully it's an ameliatory interplay between the two activities.
Yeah, my work job is structured right now, I actually do have a certain amount of time for blogging, but that's like company blogging and wouldn't necessarily cover working on the book. It would certainly go faster if I had time, because certainly trying to squeeze some parts of this into my allegedly spare time becomes challenging, especially when, you know, writing a book like this, it's not just writing a book. You're also writing, to some extent, an application, and it's not a fully featured application, but it does still have to work, and the tests have to pass and things like that. It has to work well enough so that if somebody were to copy it, that it would run. That can be frustrating when to come to writing the book and find out that, some gem is updated and now, you know, there's some weird test failure in my book is sometimes a little frustrating.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And you said that the book was, most of the examples are in Ruby on Rails. Would you see it being valuable to someone who was not doing Rails development at all, who maybe was doing something in Python or Clojure or what have you?
Some of it's in JavaScript, because the client-side Stripe library is in JavaScript. So yeah, that's a kind of an essential part of it, especially for security purposes. Some of the code would carry, because the Stripe API is actually pretty similar across a lot of these languages. And I think some of the principles would still hold. Some of the tools are a little bit Rails specific, but some of the basic ideas of, you know, separating things into background jobs, the way that you need to think about administration, you know, handling failure, like some of that I think would have some value outside of the Rails world.
Were you explicitly thinking of kind of developers with the web payment problem in general as your audience, or were you really thinking, you know, this is more for Rails people, or where did the kind of needle fall there?
The tricky part here is that it becomes very, very hard to write a book that is simultaneously like using the Rails API and like the Python API. Like, it's very confusing. And you quickly get, like, it's a 300-page book as it is. Like, and you have to make some decisions there. So while I would like it to be valuable to anybody who's doing web payments, as sort of a practical matter, Rails and the Ruby API are the ones I know best. And that's where the examples are, because they have to be in something and they can't be in everything.
Right. I remember a lot of those books that I read that used Java kind of as the lingua franca of the system that they were talking about. But it really was like, you know, you're right. There's a line that you have to tread there, because you can't just wave your hands and talk in like these abstract principles that have no grounding in reality. But at the same time, you know, you have to, by giving concrete examples, you may limit it, the potential audience. But I do think that there is a path in there where, you know, your examples are accessible to people from different backgrounds.
Examples are really hard, actually. It's a very tricky thing to have an example that is like complicated enough to get the point across, but not so complicated that you get buried in extraneous details. It's really a problem, actually, when you try to write about testing, because almost any problem that is simple enough to be an example in a book is not complicated enough to show why test-driven development is a good idea. object-oriented has the same issue a lot of times. Like you start bringing these relatively robust methodologies to these little toy problems, and it's hard to get across why they're valuable when you're working on a toy problem. Not impossible. Yeah. But, there are people who do it.
If I can count the number of tutorials that were like modeling cats and dogs and people, and I've never written a single class that even remotely resembled any of that stuff.
Yeah. And that becomes like, so then you get into start bringing it into more complicated problems, but then you become sort of sensitively dependent on the weird quirks of whatever problem you've chosen, which can be difficult. It can make it feel like it's less universal. But if the idea is that these techniques or these tools are going to help you manage the complexity in your application, then you need to show an example that actually has enough complexity for them to sort of work. It can be really challenging.
Yeah. So you mentioned also that some of the examples really fall into two camps. So some of them are in Ruby, and you're actually opinionated about making sure that the domain logic is captured in objects, which I think actually furthers that goal, where you're not really bound so much to the Rails APIs. But then you said, obviously, there's the other stuff is in JavaScript, just because there's the client-side Stripe library is implemented in JavaScript. You wrote a book on JavaScript a few years back. So clearly, it factors into your development story. I often kind of try and tell people, we are all JavaScript developers, whether you know it or not. Do you have any advice for people who are approaching JavaScript from kind of outside the core environment? What's the best way to make your angle of approach?
So I have opinions on this. The problem is I don't do big single page JavaScript apps. For the most part, it's just not part of my nutritional background at the moment. So mostly the JavaScript I'm doing is it's the kind of thing that they sort of deride as sprinkles of JavaScript.
Mm-hmm. I don't deride it. Like I said, I think everybody is, I like to say it's a far larger tent than anyone cares to acknowledge.
Yeah, I feel like my decision to try very hard to stay out of the JavaScript ecosystem battles has paid off for me tremendously. In most ways, at the same time, I don't have really strong opinions about JavaScript build tools because I haven't really had a whole lot of occasion to use them. Mm-hmm. I do think that I very strongly recommend that people coming to JavaScript now use some of the ES6 features, especially things like classes and stuff like that that give you a little bit better structure. Structure in JavaScript that's a little bit more consistent with what you would see in other programming languages. A lot of those changes were, I think, pretty beneficial to how I work with the language. One thing that I like to do when I am doing something that is smaller, too small to really bring in a framework, so I'm still mostly doing kind of jQuery, is I have a style where I really do try to isolate the jQuery and the DOM from the logic in a way that I don't always see people do, on the theory that the DOM is a big third-party dependency. In the way that on server side, the database is a big third-party dependency. And in both of those cases, we kind of pretend that they're not big third-party dependencies because it's easier to integrate them. But eventually that kind of hurts. And I find raw jQuery and raw JavaScript, that stuff very hard to read and hard to understand. So I think it does a little bit better if you start burying it behind some stuff that has some more semantic naming. And things like that. And then when you get to the point where you need a framework that actually has data binding, even if it's a small framework like Vue.js or something like that, then you have some habits that will help you as you start building that out.
Yeah. No, I think it's been interesting. Obviously we do JavaScript a lot here, but having that separation and the kind of the mental model of what is kind of my representation of the data and what's the how am I actually presenting that to the user? It's kind of scary how universal that concept is and how well it will serve you as you grow from the simplest little, one little one-liner JavaScript thing to a whole full-fledged single-page application using whatever framework you choose. If you abide by those principles, it's going to maybe not be easy, but it's going to be a lot more tractable.
Yeah, your transition to using one of those tools is going to be a lot easier if you're already in the habit of separating out your display logic from your actual logic.
Yeah. And so now you're doing, and believe me, I am not looking to draw you into any kind of controversy here with JavaScript or Rails, but in the last, several Ruby conferences that I've been to, there's been kind of a lot of talks and a lot of discussions about where's the Rails community headed? Where's the Ruby community headed? How does it fit into you know, these kind of new ecosystems that are emerging and what's the role that it's going to play down the road. And so, you know, I'm just kind of curious to get your take on that, your read on that, as someone who operates in a bunch of different kind of environments. And, you know, is Rails something that if you were starting an application from scratch, like that you would do again?
Yeah, I still pick up Rails for new applications. I think that it's especially because the ecosystem is still so far ahead of all of the newer tools ecosystems. And I still think it's still the best way for a small team to act like a big team. We're starting to investigate, you know, we're definitely investigating other stuff, other tools. We're actually having all of the TableXI developers are trying to pick a framework that they don't use every day, ideally in a language they don't use every day, and build a common app in it so that we can, you know, get a sense of just to try out some new muscles and get a sense of what the strengths and weaknesses of some of these other tools are. And we're starting to bring them in slowly to our server and client side repertoires where they're appropriate. I think that Rails is great, but it's not perfect, which leads to the possibility that there will be something better eventually. I think it will take a while for something like Phoenix and Elixir to build up the ecosystem and the number of third-party tools that the Rails community has.
Yeah, I often think that so we've been playing around with a bunch of different tools here, but I actually started a kind of a side project and I was using Rails and I was blown away. I was like, wow, I forgot how easy it actually was. And that actually can't be discounted. And things like speed and things like this lightweight feeling, it's very easy to mistake speed for the lack of an ecosystem. And like, I certainly made that mistake with Node.js. Like, you know, NPM installs at the very beginning were super fast. And that was the reason, is because you weren't installing anything at all.
Rails still prioritizes a certain kind of developer experience in a way that is really great for projects up to a certain size. And I think that there's a significant dispute over where that certain size is.
Right.
But, you know, it's still, I have a coworker who did a Rails project recently after also having done a bunch of JavaScript projects and had a very similar reaction. Like, I forgot how easy some of this stuff actually can be. And then, you know, eventually you get to a size where some of that easy starts to be less appealing in terms of something a little bit more structured. But, you know, there's still a lot of value there. I find the Node ecosystem, like, honestly, really complicated and confusing relative to the Ruby ecosystem. And some of that is just my lack of experience with it.
Yeah. We're knee deep in it every day and it's complicated. It's just, it's huge. Like, it's just mammoth compared to the Ruby ecosystem. And I don't think it started out that way, but it certainly is like that today.
It's like a little, like Rails is at least somewhat focused on a particular size problem. And I think that that makes that ecosystem a little bit more manageable. And I think that the JavaScript tools are trying to solve a lot of different problems for a lot of different people, sort of under the same umbrella. And it gets very hard to do that.
Yeah. Well, that's about it for our time. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So the name of the book that you're currently writing is?
It's Take My Money, Accepting Payments on the Web. It is available at pragprag.com. Mm-hmm. And then you can find anything I'm doing at noelrappin.com. Keep an eye out there because there's going to be a new project that hopefully will start by the end of the year. I'm a little less confident that it's going to than I was, but I'm still hoping. And then also you can find me on Twitter at noelrapp, N-O-E-L-R-A-P.
All right. Fantastic. Bye, everybody.